Hi, welcome to the podcast, Returned. I am Joe Posnanski, senior writer at the new venture Sports on Earth at sportsonearth.com, and we are starting this thing all over again because of the dozens and dozens of people who have listened in the past, I guess. Great to be doing the podcast again, and great to be doing it with my good friend Michael Schur, executive producer of the award-winning Parks and Recreation, which, if I'm not mistaken, new season. We're starting a new season, right? We're at the start of a new season.
Yes, season 5 begins on Thursday. I'm not sure when this is going to be put up on Sports on Earth, but Thursday, September 20th at 9:30. By the time you hear this, it could have been like 7 weeks ago.
7 years? I mean, we might be in, like, this thing might be broadcast while the Olympics are going on in Rio. we'll be talking like, what did they say about the Orioles? That makes no sense at all. So, but even though we are in podcast Mach 2, it's going to be really as bad as it always has been. And same equipment, I should say, right up front. So very little chance anybody's... Although this time I did hit record and play at the same time on the
recorder.
That's good. So
that sounds good, yeah. And listen, in honor of the new job and the new venture, Sports on Earth, I think we should keep this to a tight 2 hours.
The great thing is that my wife, who of course produced Mach 1 of the podcast, even she's not lowering herself to do this anymore. I mean, she basically said, like, why don't we see if that entity works before you kind of, you know, call me if you guys, you know, get an audience. So
yeah,
so I'm doing it. So I'm going to produce it actually while we go. So this thing has no chance of working. But it's great. We have not done one of these in so long. The last time we talked, the Red Sox were, we thought they'd be a good team. I mean, that's how long.
Yes, that's how long ago it was.
Wow.
It was a different world.
Like, it was insane. I have to say, I mean, we're not going to talk that much about the Red Sox because, one, I think it would be too painful, and two, they don't matter. But
no.
But we have to start. I honestly, I mean, and they've had injuries and there have been issues and all that, and they did – you know, end last year in tragic, horrible fashion, and there was all sorts of off-season turmoil and Bobby Valentine. I didn't think they'd be this bad.
Well, no one did, obviously. And to be fair to them, they didn't get this bad until they made the huge trade with the Dodgers. You know, and they took Adrian Gonzalez out of the middle of their lineup, and they traded one of their starting pitchers. They got a lot worse. And also, by the way, that's just a white flag. And then I think it's probably hard for the guys and the rest of the team to keep going out there every day when the team is obviously conceding the year. But, you know, there's a big debate right now about, which I think is amusing, about whether Bobby Valentine is going to be back next year or not, which, by the way, he's not going to be back next year.
That's what makes it amusing.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing about him in all this is, like, the team it was a perfect storm of bad luck. They had dozens, literally dozens of injuries to all of their key players. And the other guys who weren't injured, you know, horribly underperformed. Pedroia's first half was his worst half of a season of baseball in history. He was one of the only guys who was relatively healthy. And, you know, Buchholz got off to a terrible start. Anyone who wasn't injured was terrible. And so there are a lot of mitigating factors, but every single thing that Bobby Valentine did was made it worse, you know? And it's like, if the only thing you can ever ask of your manager is you don't actively make things worse. You don't actively seem like you're sabotaging the team that you're managing. And at times, even from the beginning, I mean, he criticized Euclid like 2 weeks into the season, and, you know, now then Euclid is gone, and it's amazing. It's really one of the greatest managerial sabotage performances in Major League Baseball history. It's phenomenal.
What strikes me, and I'm actually coming from this as a relative Bobby Valentine fan. I mean, I liked him. I wanted actually the Royals to hire him a few years ago when he was still in Japan. Because I just think he's a great, but he's that kind of manager. I mean, he's the manager when the Royals had hit rock bottom and there was no place to go. I just kind of thought here's a perfect guy to sort of
shake it up a little,
He'll be wandering around town. He'll be doing every kind of, you know, every single Optimist Club meeting and everything. He'll just be like, go Royals, go. I mean, he would pump life into it. Even as a person who sees Bobby Valentine as that kind of guy, I never understood it. I never understood why the Red Sox. I didn't see the fit. I certainly didn't see the fit coming off of last year's. I mean, it doesn't seem to me. It seems like if you're in the emergency room, as the Red Sox were at the end of last year, and Theo leaves, and there's all sorts of, you know, the chicken and the beer and the and all the stuff with Tito and everything else. It's like, and let's bring in, you know, Jack the Ripper. It just didn't I don't understand why they thought that was like the fit for this team.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I was trying to be optimistic when it happened. I think, in fact, the last time we did a podcast, I was sort of like, well, here's why it might work. And then it seems very silly now. But I think that the lesson is when you're a team with a huge payroll and a lot of superstars in a high-pressure media environment, blah, 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 what you want is Joe Torre. Yeah. What you want is a smart guy who has the respect of his players, who sits quietly on the bench and drinks green tea every day, because ultimately, like, that's what holds teams together over the course of the year in good times and bad, is like just a steady guiding hand. And Bobby Valentine is essentially, he's a circus clown. He's the farthest you can get from a steady guiding hand. And I think that there was some kind, I'm guessing there was some kind of theory about, well, last year maybe the players had too much control. Maybe they got out of hand, or there was a discipline issue where they, you know, they got too comfortable. That's so much better than this. Like, it's so much better to have your team be like too happy and comfortable and push around their manager a little bit. As long as the manager is willing to kind of like publicly defend them and try to just hold things together, that is such a better situation than a crazy, like, roll of the dice, you never know what you're going to get, wild card lunatic running around giving quotes to the most aggressive attack dog local media that exists in America.
Yeah, you know, it is funny because I'm not a believer, as many people are, that there is a huge, huge difference playing in Philadelphia or New York or Boston than it is playing in Milwaukee or Cincinnati. Or, you know, I know that's a very common theory, and there probably are a few differences. But I kind of think a lot of that is overplayed. I think that baseball is on the field, and when you play it, your preparation and the work you do off the field is so, it doesn't seem to affect that much. However, managing the Boston Red Sox and the New York Yankees and the Philadelphia Phillies, very, very different. I think that's where the differences are enormous from being in, you know, in Kansas City or Cincinnati. You know, you go after the game and there's one reporter, two reporters. I mean, really, on the road, that's what it's like. You know, maybe a camera, maybe not. And of course, in Boston and New York and Philly, it's hugely, you know, it's just so intense, and a loss is just the kind of thing that could blow up your team, rather than it just being something you have to explain to, you know, Bob Dutton of the Kansas City Star. I mean, it's just a different environment. And,
sure.
And Bobby Valentine has done the big city thing, obviously, with the Mets. But it was the second big city thing. I mean, some of his, like, showmanship and all that, he was kind of trying to fight against the whole Yankee thing anyway. I just don't know. I mean, I'd rather have Charlie Manuel, you know, over there saying things nobody understands him, and just kind of just but you laugh and you're like, hey, that's a good story, the part I caught, and then you move on. Bobby Valentine can't not be in the news. He cannot avoid that kind of environment. And I'm not saying that can't work. Maybe it worked with Billy Martin. Maybe it does work occasionally. But it seemed like an awful risk for the Red Sox.
Yeah, and I think that the facts would bear that out, right? it would be hard to make any other argument at this point.
I think we should have that amusing conversation about whether Bobby Valentine's going to be back next year. people are really arguing about that. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of last year when the Mets were like, you know, obviously after all of the Madoff stuff came out and everything, the Mets are just barely clinging to life. And they're just like daily stories about, hey, I think they might re-sign Jose Reyes. I'm thinking, you know, it's like, with what? I mean, they're going to pass the hat around? I mean, how are they going to do that? But that was like a legitimate conversation for a long time. And that seems to me what this is. It's something to talk about. Oh, well, I don't know. You know, maybe 1 year is not enough time. He's gone, right? I mean, he's just.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, it's also just, it's been a long time since the Red Sox were in last place, 17 games out of first or whatever it is. So, like.
You know when the last time it was? When was the last time? Do you know?
God, I would guess 92 or something.
I just stumped Bill James with this one. It works for the Red
Sox. Oh, really?
Never happened since they've gone to divisional play. Now, you go back to the 30s in the American League. But in divisional play, the Boston Red Sox have never finished in last place.
Very interesting.
How about that? How's that little tidbit for you?
So now I'm even happier.
Doesn't that make your day even better? All right, we're through talking with the Red Sox. By the way, we will have our draft coming up in just a little bit, and I should say for this draft that I've really prepared hard because I haven't been in podcast studio in a little while. So when I sat down here, I saw there was still a note here from my oldest daughter, just humiliated by my Star Wars draft. Just humiliated. I have to tell you this. This is absolutely true. I watched all 5 seasons of The Wire this summer. I had never seen The Wire. I had never, I'd heard, a million things about it. Always wanted to, never had the time. Watched all 5 seasons of The Wire this summer. Basically, because I figure at some point we might end up in a Wire draft, and I just can't let that happen to me again.
Yeah, that point will be the next time we do one of these things, by the way. I'm just telling you right now, that's what's going to happen. It's going to be Wire characters.
Wire characters, and I'd be just sitting there like going, Bubbles? I mean, that would be bad. It would not be good. So I did my due diligence on that. But we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to go around the league a little bit with baseball since the last time we did this thing, we actually predicted who was going to win each division. And as you might remember, we got them all right. It's amazing.
Yeah, right now, as things have lined up, we nailed every single division.
Every single one. And obviously, you never know because a couple things could still happen. But us picking the Orioles, genius. Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing.
Genius. Nobody else.
And by the way, we were laughed at when we chose the Orioles. A lot of our friends laughed at us. But we said, no, you watch this. They're going to be outscored by 20 runs. And yet they're going to be only a game out of first.
Well, I thought you made that great point. I remember that great point. You said, I'm looking at this team and I'm seeing a team that will probably have the greatest one-run record in history of baseball. That's what I see.
I believe you predicted that they would go undefeated in extra inning games, didn't you? I remember that now.
How the heck are they doing this? I mean, it's great. I love it. I just had a conversation with Keith Law about this. And Keith works for ESPN, of course. And Keith and I love Keith. I love talking to him. But we just come at it from such different ways. He's coming at it with such just like dismay. It's just like, how is this horrible team winning?
Yeah.
And I come at it from, how is this horrible team winning? This is awesome. So we see it the same way. It's great. What a great, great story in Baltimore.
It's a great story. It's obviously, if it's not the best story in baseball, it's one of the 3 best stories in baseball. And the thing is, they're not a terrible team.
No,
they're not awful.
No.
They're just mediocre. They should be 81-ish, and they're going to be somewhere between 15 and 25 games over 500. And it's amazing. It's a complete smoke and mirrors. I mean, it's a really I believe that. When all is said and done, it'll be one of the flukiest complete seasons that we've seen in a really long time. They have no business being a game out of first and leading the wild card in the American League or, in the wild card race even.
Yeah.
And, they have a fairly easy rest of schedule. They're at Seattle and Boston, and obviously Boston is nowheresville. Then they're home against Toronto and Boston, and Toronto and Boston are both mediocre/terrible teams. They close the year at Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay has been faltering recently, so there's a decent chance that they can go on a run for the rest of the year and pull ahead of New York. I mean, New York has a slightly harder schedule, maybe not very hard, but they're home against Toronto. They're home against Oakland. Then they have to go to Minnesota and Toronto, which is 2 bad teams. And then they're home against Boston. Boston will be more excited to play the Yankees than they will be the Orioles. And to, go to, if Boston can go to Yankee Stadium and the Yankees and Orioles are tied, you'll see Boston play as hard as they played all year. So it's actually possible that the Baltimore Orioles win the AL East. As we speak right now, they're a game out of first.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to say about it. I mean, it's a complete fluke. It's a decent team. you know, they're not terrible. They don't do anything really badly, but they also don't do anything really well. They just have gotten incredibly lucky, and they seem to play really hard, and they've got a couple, you know, really, you know, top line players. And then other than that, they're just sort of a 500 team that's had an unbelievable year.
Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously you and I are both really, you know, statistically based thinkers, and, you know, we attribute stuff that we don't fully appreciate, you know, which a lot of people will attribute to clutch ability or mm-hmm. guts or whatever. We attribute a lot of that to luck and sort of the odds, you know, working as they work and so on. But this is a team, when you have that good a one-run record, and Keith said it best. I mean, he said, you know, there's just too much background noise to know what it means. But it is true, their bullpen until the last, you know, few days, and we're talking here on you know, Monday, so I have no idea when people will hear this. But their bullpen has been pretty good, you know, yep. in fact, really good at times. And you know, that's... You have a really good bullpen. You know, you scrap out some runs, and you know, you win all the one run games you play in, and you're going to have a good season. And that's they're not a bad team. They're not a bad team by any stretch. No. But they're not, you know, they're not good enough to be doing what they're doing. Except they are, you know, and that's the great thing. It's the great thing about baseball. I would love, obviously, I would love to see this thing go to the final weekend, you know, and, sure. and it might not. I mean, obviously, the Orioles at any point, it could blow up or whatever. But, and like it does, by the way, did again this year in Pittsburgh, that nothing depresses me more these days than watching Pittsburgh absolutely do what you knew they were going to do. You know,
yeah.
this is second straight year that they've come into August, really, not just a good chance, but I mean, they're right in the middle of it. And, you know, they were better this year, which, you know, led to having to be worse down the stretch, which they have lived up to. I mean, that's depressing. I don't want that to happen to the Orioles.
Yeah, I don't either. I think if you're not, you know, if your team is out of it, as mine is, and you're not rooting for the Orioles, I don't want to know you. I mean, how can you not root for this team? It's like, it's 15 years since they had a winning season,
right.
and now they have a chance to win the best, you know, probably the best division in baseball. If not, it's a slightly off year for the East, but it would just be such a great story. I mean, there's a lot of stories like that. There's Oakland in the East.
Sure.
I mean, in the West, there's, you know, there's, Washington, obviously, in the NL East. There's a lot of these divisions have these teams that are just, you know, out of nowhere, nobody saw coming teams, and that just makes baseball. That's why baseball is fun.
Well, which leads to the conversation of the second wild card. So obviously,
yeah.
the second wild card was supposed to do two things, which it is doing both of these things this year. One, it was supposed to make the division races that much more crucial. Obviously, if Baltimore beat the Yankees last year, it would be okay. That's cool, but let's see what they do in the playoffs.
Right.
This year, if the Orioles somehow beat the Yankees, it's huge. It's absolutely huge because now the Yankees have to play in the one-game play-in, which they'd have to play probably Oakland at this point. And if they did that, that's 50-50 right there. I mean, that's an absolute 50-50 shot. Mm-hmm. They're not much better than Oakland. They probably have a better record, so it'd be at Yankee Stadium, so maybe it's 52-48 or, you know, but it's a flip of a coin.
Yep.
You know, slightly leaning Yankee, and even if they win that, they've blown their number one starter for the rest of the playoffs, or
they've blown the number one starter if they have their number one starter
right.
available. I mean, it depends on how it breaks down, right? I mean, if you in your last two games, if you're the Yankees and you throw Sabathia and Kuroda or something, you have a one game playoff. Who starts that game?
That's
Ivan.
Right.
Suddenly, your season is Ivan on Ivan Nova's shoulders on his sore shoulder. And it is a true wild card situation,
yes.
which is exciting.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I still don't think I like this second wild card thing. I think we're nearing true dilution of the baseball playoffs. I thought the system they had before was pretty good. You know, it's three division winners and a wild card. But we'll see how it turns out. I mean, it might lead to some really exciting play-in games, and if it does and it works out, then I'll, you know, I'm not a super purist. I didn't get upset when they went from two divisions to three and added a wild card and all that stuff. I think that's all been good for the game. I think it's kept more teams in it. But now, you know, it's less so in the AL than it is in the NL, because in the NL there's, you know, there's teams that are 500 teams that are legitimately in the playoff race, which I think is a problem.
That's absolutely right, and that's what I was going to say. That's the second part of it, is that it was going to make it more exciting for other teams. But now you have, you know, a desperately fading Cardinals team, a Dodgers team that they don't even know what they are. They have no idea. They just truckloads of all-stars just show up at their door. They're like, yeah, put them in the lineup somewhere. You know, that team, I was watching that Cardinals game, Cardinals-Dodgers over the weekend, and it's like every so often they'll put somebody out there. And, I mean, I follow the Dodgers like I follow any other team, but I just am suddenly like, forget. Like, oh, yeah, that's right. They have Hanley Ramirez. It's like, oh, and Shane Victorino and Adrian Gonzalez and Matt Kemp. And, you know, and all of a sudden you're just like, what is this? I mean, how did this, you know, fantasy team end up in L.A. and why are they terrible? You know, I mean, it's like, yeah. it doesn't seem to make any sense. But you have them, and then, like you said, you have these 500 teams. You got the Milwaukee, sort of like, hey, we're still here, and Philadelphia. I mean, I wrote off Philadelphia in June, and now they're, like, sticking their nose in there. So I don't like it. I mean, but I understand why people would like it. But that second part of the wild card thing, it's not doing this in the American League, because the American League, pretty much the five teams are in. I mean, we don't know who's going to win the Central between the Tigers and the White Sox. But in general, no other team, you know, the Angels are trying to get back in it, and maybe they're, you know, working their way in. But in general, it's like we kind of know what the five teams are. But in the National League, we have no idea. That second wild card could be pretty much anybody at this point.
Yeah, and it bums me out. You know, Atlanta's got one locked up, basically, unless they pass the Nationals. But I don't know. I don't think it's good for baseball that – It starts to feel like basketball, and I say this lovingly to the NBA because I enjoy watching the NBA playoffs, but it's always kind of weird when there's like four playoff teams that have losing records or 500 records. And, you know, there's a decent chance that Milwaukee wins the wild card. With the way that the Dodgers are weirdly fading since trading for everyone who was available, there's a decent chance that Milwaukee is the wild card, you know, second wild card winner at like, you know, 80 with 83 wins or something. I don't think that's good. It bums me out on some basic level. I feel like that in order to make the playoffs in baseball, you need to be a decent team. And there's going to be a team, whether it's the Cardinals or the Dodgers or the Brewers or theoretically the Pirates, if they had a late run, or the Phillies, there's just going to be a team that's kind of like, really, like 83 wins gets you to the playoffs now. Now, obviously, you know, the Cardinals won the World Series a few years ago, and they had what, 86 wins that year, right?
So I think they were 84, didn't they? I mean, there was
84,
you know,
85.
The 87 Twins. I mean, there are some very, very close to 500 teams that have actually gone on to win the World Series.
Yeah, so I guess it's not that different. And, you know, the Seahawks had a home playoff game, and they were 7-9. And it's like this is an aspect of sports, right? This is the way to achieve growth in your sport, if you've hit a ceiling, is to just add playoff teams and have more postseason. And, you know, I'm sure that this is a boon for baseball. The contract that they just signed with ESPN is massive, and they're going to sign other contracts, local contracts and national contracts and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure a big part of it is like, hey, postseason baseball, it's in prime time in October, and it's good for the networks and all that sort of stuff. But it just, when you look at the NL wildcard standings, I get a little queasy about it.
Well, and here's why I think it's different in baseball, because you mentioned, let's talk about the NBA. So every year, some bad team makes it to the NBA, either 500, below 500, maybe there are two or three teams in the East that make it that are, you know, right around there. But here's the thing about the NBA. It's self-correcting. Those teams never do anything, because you have to win a 3 out of 5 or a 4 out of 7 in the NBA, where the better team beats the worst team a lot more often than it happens in baseball, where the better team beats the worst team. I mean, the worst team beats the better team more often in baseball than it does in basketball. So, and I think more or less that's true in hockey. You don't just, every so often a team will make a little run in hockey with a hot goalie or whatever, but in those two sports, And I would argue for the most part in the NFL, although the NFL has its exceptions as well, if you are a bad team and you make it into the playoffs, it's nice. It's good for your town. It's a cool story. And you're gone relatively quickly. I mean, you don't.
Yeah.
In baseball, there's no question. If Milwaukee would make it into the postseason, or if Philadelphia would, after having a very, very mediocre season for the most part, they absolutely would have a shot to win the World Series. I mean, they'd have a legitimate chance to win the World Series. And that's what, I mean, that Cardinals team that was, you know, just about had the worst collapse in the history of the world in 06, or I guess was it 06? I guess, was that the year?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Won the World Series. And then last year, of course, they were 500 in August and they got hot and won the World Series. I mean, it can definitely happen in baseball a lot more easily than can happen in any other sport. And I think that's why baseball's always been different about it. You know, fewer teams in the playoffs, and it's a longer season, and we're only going to put the best teams. I mean, I think I am a little bit of a purist anyway, but I agree with Keith Law. I don't want to see bad teams in the postseason. I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
It's more baseball, and I'm always for more baseball and all that, but that's not what I want. To me, I think the season, I equate baseball a lot more with soccer, where in soccer they're like, you have the best record, you're the champion, congratulations, you know, and even if you're the best team by, you know, 10, 15 points or whatever, and the last month of the season is a bore to everybody, it doesn't matter. That's still, they're like, no, though, we have a way of picking the best team. That's how baseball's been, and it's been adding a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. It feels to me like the second wild card is kind of, it feels like a even more of a gimmick than some of the other things, at least to me.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate, even though I agree with you. I'll play devil's advocate just for a second, because then you get into the question of what is a bad team, right? So, like St. Louis, for example, is 11 games behind the Reds as of this moment in the Central. And you go, oh, well, gosh, the Reds are good and the Cardinals are mediocre. But St. Louis has a better run differential than Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. They have a far better offense and a worse, pitching staff, but not that much worse. I mean, they're plus 83 right now, and Cincinnati's plus 78. So then you say, okay, well, what makes a bad team or a mediocre team? Like, if you left it up to purely the statistical expectation, then St. Louis would be a game or two ahead of Cincinnati. So the counter argument, I guess, would be that it's fun when unexpected things happen. It's fun when the Orioles, who have been outscored on the year, are game out of first in the AL East, and it's fun when the Nationals come out of nowhere and have the best run differential in the National League and run away with the East. These unexpected things are fun, and what the playoffs are is just a really like short-term unexpected festival where anything can happen, and throw a bunch of teams in there that are great and that are at least pretty good and just see what happens. I mean, you know, the NFL has lived on this for a long time now. The reason that the NFL has so completely captured the country's imagination, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but I think one of them is that the phrase any given Sunday applies now more than it ever has. I mean, the Cardinals went to Foxborough yesterday and beat the Patriots on a blocked punt and a 2-yard touchdown and all this crazy stuff, and then should have thrown the game away, ran a toss sweep with a minute left and the Patriots had no timeouts, lost a fumble, and then one of the best kickers in football shanked a 40-yard field goal. They have that going for them in football where you just never, ever, ever, ever know. And maybe baseball's attitude here is, let's try to get some of that unpredictability. Let's have people in Baltimore and Detroit and Milwaukee and Cincinnati and San Francisco and everywhere else thinking that right down to, you know, on September 17th, thinking just get us into that tournament and anything can happen. And maybe they're right. Maybe that would help the game.
Well, I mean, it has helped the game. I mean, honestly, I mean, obviously the various things, I mean, as far as popularity goes, as far as attendance goes, I mean, there's no arguing with the way baseball is going. I mean, it's going up. And I wouldn't even disagree with anything that you said that you sort of agree with yourself. I mean, you know, where you're playing devil's advocate. I think all of that's true. I think football, though, is more geared that way. I mean, if baseball only played 40 games a year or 60 games a year or something. It could definitely have that unpredictability. You know, over 40 games in baseball, anybody could win. Literally anybody could win. I mean, the Yankees could be in last, the Red Sox could be in first. If you pick the right 40 games, anybody could win the thing. That's why football has. I mean, if football played 162 games, first of all, they'd all be dead. But second,
they'd
all die. I was going to say one other thing that football has going for it that baseball doesn't is that at no point will you be watching like Felix Hernandez pitching and then him just get blindsided, just completely blindsided. So that's another thing football has going for it. Look, the NFL is great and it's a great system. It's awesome. Once a week is genius. It is. It's Sundays, and it's like everything around, you know, of course, now they play them, you know, Monday and Thursday and all that, but it's like one time a week, you build up all of this expectation, you build your entire day around it. Baseball doesn't have that. And that's why I don't think baseball can win on football's, you know, system. I mean, and again, look, most people, I think baseball fans would feel, and I feel this way somewhat myself, hey, more playoff baseball is more playoff baseball. It's more opportunity to watch the game. These are great players. Even teams that are not particularly that I think aren't great teams. I want to watch Matt Holliday play. I want to watch Carlos Beltran play. I want to watch Ryan Braun hit. All of these things even out. And I'm not saying that baseball can't be super successful because they are being super successful that way. What I'm just saying is that I think baseball is kind of getting away from what has been its core for a long time, which is you play a long season, you've determined who the best teams are, then you play in the postseason with these teams, you know. And instead, it's become much more like, all right, you have a long season, and then we pick like a bunch of those teams, and then they play kind of their own long season, and then it's like it's like March Madness, it's a lot of people love it. A lot of my friends think I'm a total stick in the mud with my thinking about the playoffs. So I'll be watching, so that they're not going to lose me no matter what they do.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that long, slow accumulation of greatness is obviously means less right now. Mm-hmm. It still means something, but it means less than it used to. But if the Orioles pull ahead of the Yankees and then the Yankees have a one-game playoff with Oakland, and that game is 3-3 in the eighth inning, that's going to be unbelievably exciting.
No question.
So it's hard to argue against it because it has the potential to. I mean, the counter argument, right, is if you get into a weird situation where the National League one game playoff is St. Louis and Pittsburgh, and St. Louis is up 7-0 in the fourth inning, and you're like, well, this was pointless. That's true of any sport, obviously, that there's a potential for greatness and a potential for mediocrity. But I think that last year, what happened on the last day of the baseball season was so exciting. They'll never possibly even come close to recreating it with any kind of playoff system. And so this might be a bust for a couple of years. And if it's a bust for a couple of years, I think you're going to have people get kind of bummed out about the new system. But I don't know. We'll see. It's not going backwards. They never go backwards.
No, they're not going to go backward. And I honestly don't know how much of a bust it could be. I mean, because at the end of the day, if the Orioles would pass the Yankees, it really wouldn't matter what that one game playoff would be. I mean, like how it would turn out. Leading into a Yankees-Oakland one-game playoff with the loser going home, that's what it's all about. I mean, that's what made September baseball great. So they are creating an extraordinary amount of tension and pressure and excitement, and that's awesome. It feels manufactured to me. I mean, it just feels like, and this way you're going to get it every year, and it's going to be always going to be this, and there's always going to be a bunch of teams involved, and Maybe that's the way it has to be anymore. I mean, I remember the thing that I thought about last year's last game of the play of the regular season was what made it so great was it never happens. It's never like that. But if it's like that every year, it's kind of like how I felt about interleague play. The first year of interleague play, I thought, oh, this is so awesome. I mean, you get to see the Indians and the Reds and the Mets and the Yankees and the White Sox and the Cubs, and okay, now I don't care. I mean, you know, now it's 15, 20 years later, and they've played 100 times, and it's like, all right, and now next year they're going to have interleague games every week, and
right.
I don't even know why you have two leagues at this point. I mean, it doesn't feel special anymore. So short term, it's great, but I do have questions about the long term. All right, so now we get to determine who actually is going to make the playoffs. And the great thing is, by the time people hear this, they'll know that we're wrong. So, and that's assuming they actually ever do hear us on this thing. All right, but in the National League, we'll start there because it's I think you got four locks, pretty much. Washington, Atlanta. I think Washington's going to hold on, but either way, those two teams are getting in. Cincinnati has run away with the Central, and San Francisco has now at this point run away with the West. So you got four. You're really just dealing with one wild card team. Who do you think's the best team?
Well, I mean, I'm going to just go off of run differential and say the Cardinals. I mean, they're plus 83. They should have the same record as Atlanta, and they're seven games behind them. And I know now we're dealing with a kind of a short season. We're dealing with a 17 game season or something. So there's less of a good chance for a course correction or a regression of the mean. But I just, you know, the Dodgers are 3-7 in their last 10 games. They don't seem to have any cohesion at all. There's obviously a chance that, you know, Adrian Gonzalez starts hitting like Adrian Gonzalez and that Beckett has some good games and that they're, you know, but they've been dealt a lot of bad injuries this year. And I'm going to say St. Louis just based on what should have happened instead of what has happened.
Yeah, I mean, and the Cardinals are the exact opposite story of the Orioles, right? I mean, they have a terrible record in one-run games and a terrible record in extra innings, and that's you know, that's baseball. So that's what it comes down to. But I am actually going to disagree with you because it would be boring podcasting if I didn't. And I'm going to say that I think the Dodgers will actually end up winning only because I think and I would actually like to see the Cardinals get in. I'm a big Beltran fan, obviously, and I do think they've been the best team of that group throughout the year. But, you know, they're beat up and they're old and they just look defeated. I don't know. There just feels something about them just feels defeated. Of course, that's true of the Dodgers too, but I keep waiting. I just keep waiting for one point Don Mattingly to like kind of wake up and go, I've got a whole team of superstars. Why we need to actually like win some games. I really think, and look, they've obviously with the Kershaw injuries and Matt Kemp has not been healthy and all of these things, but I still look around at that team and just think, how? I really thought they were going to catch the Giants, right? They made that trade, and what were they, one back or two back? And they just went in free fall, and the Giants have played great, which is awesome, by the way. I love the scene out there as well. But that Dodgers team, I mean, am I wrong? I mean, maybe I am thinking 5 years ago, but that team is loaded.
Oh, no, it's ridiculous. But, you know, there's all these hidden things. Like, you know, Kershaw's has this injury, and Matt Kemp ran into a wall and immediately started hitting like 070. And he's clearly hurt. And Andre Ethier does what Andre Ethier always does, which is he gets up to this incredible first half. And, you know, he looked like this is the year he, you know, really ascends into that upper echelon of guys. And then he has kind of faded out but it is ridiculous. I mean, Ethier, Kemp, Adrian Gonzalez, Hanley Ramirez, you know, they've got four legitimate superstar guys. Like, they should be mashing the ball. And they've scored, I mean, obviously, Gonzalez hasn't been on the team for very long, but they've scored 574 runs this year. I mean, they've scored nothing. They cannot score. And I think that that park obviously suppresses offensive a fair amount and everything else, but it is weird. It's just weird. I mean, they should be a lot better than they are. And weirdly, they were better than they are before they traded for Adrian Gonzalez.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre. And we're talking about a handful of games. It's probably true that if this were May 1st, then they were seven games back of the Giants, you might say like, well, whatever, it's May 1st. Right. I think they're going to go on a crazy run and catch him, but they just ran out of time. And I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they, you know, won 10 in a row and caught the and pass the Cardinals, but it doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. I'm gonna stick with them. I mean, they're a game back as we speak behind the Cardinals in that division. In the wild card race, it just seems so strange to me when they made that trade. I mean, I thought we've talked about it from the Red Sox side, and clearly that was just a cleansing for the Red Sox.
Yeah,
we're just like, all right, you know what? Nothing we've done for the last 2 years has worked. We're dumping everybody, but we're going to keep Bobby Valentine. No, they're not. They're dumping him too, and we're going to try to sort of rework ourselves. And John Henry is going to become more involved and whatever. Okay, I get it. But from the Dodgers' perspective, I honestly thought at the time that was one of those trades where, like, if somebody makes that trade in fantasy, like in your fantasy league, you're like totally going to the commissioner and going, "That's not, you can't, he can't make that
trade. Yeah,
you cannot make that trade." Like this close to the end of the year. I mean, you cannot just pick up like superstars for nothing at the end of the year. It hasn't. I guess there's your difference between fantasy baseball and real baseball, one of the many differences.
That's the only one, actually. That's the one difference.
Although Adrian Gonzalez is killing your fantasy league, too. And let's be honest about it. All right, American League. Texas and Oakland, they're both going to make it. That's a little bit of a race. I mean, the A's have played so well. The Rangers will probably hold on, but those two teams are in. Really, what we're talking about is White Sox, Tigers, which really is, in my mind, the one old-fashioned pennant race going.
Because
losers out. They don't even get a one-game playoff play-in. And I have – both of them are very mediocre teams, really.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea how the White Sox are holding off the Tigers, though. They're really holding them off. I mean, they're up two now, and it feels like they might make it to the finish line. I'm very surprised by that.
Yeah, Detroit bummed me out, frankly. I thought they would be a lot better than they are, and I think I may have predicted them to win the Central when we did our predictions at the beginning of the year, but I honestly don't remember. No,
and we won't remember until the season's over and we see who actually won the division.
Yeah.
And we determine that.
Yeah, but I mean, the Chicago is a very, very average pitching team. I mean, they have Chris Sale, who's ridiculous and great.
Great here.
And then they have some other people who also pitch for them. And you can almost say that the two-game difference between the White Sox and the Tigers this year is Adam Dunn, which is so amazing. I mean, his year last year was one of the worst, maybe the worst offensive year for anyone who's played. You know, I think he played in like 120 games or something.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But it was hard. It would be hard to be worse than he was last year. I think he hit 152 or something.
Right.
And he had 11 home runs in 120 games. And this year he's got an 840 OPS and he's going to hit 40 home runs again, probably. I mean, that's the difference between these two teams. If they don't have Adam Dunn, if Dunn isn't there on the White Sox, if it's someone else, it's entirely possible that Detroit is in first place. And again, it's just like, who saw that coming? I mean, except that, you know, he's still only like 33 or something.
You know,
he's still like he's not like he was 38 last year and you're like, oh, well, he fell off the cliff. He just fell off a cliff when he was 31,
right.
and then he came back, scrambled back up the cliffside, and now he's hitting again. It's just so crazy.
Yeah, I don't want to self congratulate here, but I did think he'd bounce back. I didn't think he'd bounce back to be among the league leaders in home runs or whatever. But everything about last year felt so strange because it wasn't like. I mean, if you we talk about guys falling off a cliff like Dale Murphy did at the end of his career or something, and there's a pattern to it. I mean, you see them, like their average goes down, but they still hit 25 home runs or their home run totals go down. Nobody just becomes like the worst hitter in baseball history like overnight. So
yeah.
I don't know what happened, if he was hurt, if he was mentally gone, if there was something, you know, weird that just kind of kept building on itself or whatever. But I thought he would kind of bounce back, but he's kind of what he was 2 years ago. I mean, he still his average is what, 200, 220. I mean, he's still you know, a swing and miss machine. But when he hits it, it goes, and he's walking again, and I mean he's definitely, you know, this is, if he'd had this year last year, everybody would have said, yeah, that was a great signing by the White Sox, and you know, now he's come back and he's kind of himself again. I agree with you. I mean, I think he's a big difference. Chris, the emergence of Chris Sale is a huge, huge aspect because, I mean, Sale is really, I mean, not that you match him up this way, but he's really pitched with Verlander. I mean, that's, you know, everybody, it was all about Verlander. But, I mean, Sale's been, you know, as good. And there they are. So that's going to be interesting to watch down the stretch. And then are you going to make your pick on the Yankees and Orioles?
Well, the Yankees, it's very interesting. They've basically been 500 since the break. I think they were 52-33 at the break, and they're now, let me see, they're 83-63. So, yeah, they're a game over 500 since the break. And they really are not that good. And the reason that they're not that good is, to me, is they don't have Sabathia isn't pitching like a kind of, quote, number one, end quote, guy. You know, Kuroda is arguably better than Sabathia. If you were in that one-game playoff, I'm sure they would start Sabathia, but an argument could be made to start Kuroda. And they also have this weird thing where they only, and I don't know whether it's the park or their lineup or whatever, they essentially only hit home runs.
Yeah.
Their entire offense is built around home runs. Now, when you're a bunch of good home run hitters, then that's fine. But you look at some of their statistics on the year, and it's really fluky and weird. I mean, they've like Curtis Granderson is hitting like 235, but he's going to hit 40 home runs. And
right.
Nick Swisher is, you know, 250, and he's got 20 something or 30. And Teixeira is the same way, and obviously he's hurt now. But all they do is hit home runs, and I can't figure out whether it's just the case that the park. Maybe it's that the park is encouraging, especially the left-handed guys, and all three of the switchers are switch hitter, but all three of those guys are, and so is Teixeira, they all hit left-handed a lot in Yankee Stadium. And maybe they've just adjusted their swings intentionally or unintentionally to try to hit home runs, but it's ridiculous. They are a massive, massive, massive part of their offense comes from home run hitting. And traditionally, that hasn't been a great formula for winning in the over the long postseason. And I think they're going to hold off the Orioles. They're a better team than the Orioles, and you have to assume that they're going to, you know, they don't have a super tough schedule for the rest of the year and everything else. I think they're going to hold off the Orioles, and then the Orioles will get the wild card. But it would not surprise me at all to see the Yankees make a very quick exit from the playoffs.
Well, we did talk quite a bit at the beginning of the year about some of the flaws of the Yankees, and a lot of them have come true. I mean, they've in many ways have played better. I think they remind me a little bit in the home run thing. Excuse me. They remind me a little bit of like those White Sox teams that were pretty good in the 2000s. That's all they did. They didn't get on base.
Yeah.
I mean, this Yankee team gets on base, but for the most part. But you know, they didn't get on base. They hit home runs. That's what that White Sox team did. That's a little bit what this Yankees team did. But I don't think it's fair for me. You know, and I don't know how you feel about this, to talk about the Yankees without making reference to really an absurd year by Derek Jeter offensively. I to say that I didn't see it coming is thoroughly unfair to Derek Jeter. I had him buried. I mean, literally, I had like the tombstone already written, and he was done. He was going to be an incredibly mediocre guy the last couple of years of that deal, and the Yankees were going to have to live with it, and that was okay because he's such a great player and first ballot Hall of Famer and all that. And the guy is so smart and has such a good sense of how to like maximize his talents. He's just and I'm totally, as he's having it, like he got off to that great start, I'm like, yeah, forget it, don't worry about it, he's gonna get old. No, I mean, we're here, we're in September, mid-September. And he's hitting 320 and with a 360 or 370 on base and a 440 or something slugging. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Absolutely.
The only consolation I take is that he's going to spend eternity in hell.
Okay. Okay.
Because he made a deal with the devil and he sold his soul and for another 3 good years. Maybe he wants to make a run at Rose's record, I don't know.
Okay.
And you know what? Good for him, because when he spends eternity in hell, I hope he feels like it was worth it.
I think that's fair.
And if it was, you know, if he does break P. Rose's record, if he has another 3 or 4 years like this one, and he makes a run at it, good for him. I'll be right there cheering him on, because I'll know in my heart and soul that when he dies, his soul will be tormented eternally in hell.
Eternally in hell.
That's the only possible. I mean, honestly, like, you know, he got off to a huge start. He got off to a really good start. And it was a classic thing where every time I checked in on him, you know, he was beating out an infield single and then like looping a ball to right center. And I was like, well, this is fluky. It'll end. And then his average started to fade, right? Like, you know, after he had a huge April, and then in May and June, if you look at his numbers, his average started to fade. And I was like, right, this is what happens. There's a course correction. He's regressing to the mean. Everything's fine. And then he just turned it on again. And now he's, you know, and you like this, your heart starts to sink if you're me, because you look at him and you realize like, no, he's hitting 325 and it's September 17th. Like there isn't time for him to go for his next 150 to get his average down to where I believed it would be at the beginning of the year. And it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, obviously he's one of the greatest players of all time. There's no question, but I was really counting on a little schadenfreude of getting to watch him stink for 2 years.
Well, and it's funny because I remember very distinctly in our preseason, you know, podcast in the Mach 1 version, I remember specifically asking you if you wanted to see Mariano Rivera just fade off or if you wanted to see him absolutely get lit up for a full season. And you had real issues with the question. You were like, well, you know, I mean, I guess maybe, but doesn't seem like Jeter really offers you those sorts of same that same difficult decision making. You really don't want to see him succeed anymore.
No, I wanted to watch him hit 190, and I wanted to watch him play shortstop and have balls that were hit 6 yards to his right or left, you know, scoot through, and then you know, and him lope after them like it was old timers day. That's I wanted to watch him be humiliated because he has tormented me for so long. And obviously Rivera has too, but Rivera is a different situation because Rivera's presence in the games is only at the very end. He's the quiet ninja assassin who sneaks into your room and you look up and he's there and he just whispers shh before he, you know, before he garrots you with a piano wire. So that's a different kind of guy. You know, Jeter, I just, you know, people have been arguing about Jeter for a long time and saying that, you know, he was overrated defensively. He's won like, you know, 4 Gold Gloves or something. And people like me have been screaming and yelling that he was getting those Gold Gloves because of his offensive abilities and his popularity. And we had all of these kind of like, you know, arguments for why he wasn't as good as people said he was. And then he goes out when he's like 38 and hits 325. You know, he'll be a top five. He doesn't deserve it, but he'll be a top five MVP guy this year. I mean, he's had an incredible year, and it begrudgingly makes me, you know, once again have to admit that he's, you know, one of the greatest to ever play the position, if not the greatest.
So you're saying he's kind of, if Mariano is kind of that quiet ninja, he's like the Bruce Lee that like punches you in the chest, pulls out your heart, shows it to you, that whole thing. You know, it's funny because he's still, I mean, and after having all these glowing words, he's still not a good shortstop. I mean, he's having it. No, he isn't. Defensively, he is not. I mean, I watch him. The ball doesn't have to be hit 3 feet to his left. He ain't getting to it. He's not a good defensive shortstop. I mean, he's very smooth and he doesn't make errors, but he can't get to anything. And, you know, so that's there. And that's why I think, you know, he will get MVP votes and he shouldn't. I mean, he's, you know, I mean, and especially because the guy next to him, Robbie Cano, is just 10 times more deserving, you know, as a player. But all that said, you just can't discount this offensive performance. I mean, it's just, it is extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. It's probably as good a 38-year-old year for a shortstop. You know, you probably have to go back to, you know, Hannes Wagner or something. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing year and all credit to him. And he'll have to just live with what he did, you know. that's his issue, you know. All right, it's time. It is time for the draft. It's actually past time for the draft. I've been keeping an eye on the clock. We're way behind. Even our usual timing. So this year's draft... Margo is just downstairs. My wife is just downstairs at this point, just laughing that she doesn't.
Just shaking her head sadly.
Well, and laughing that she doesn't have to deal with this anymore. So our draft this week is going to be greatest individual seasons all sports, with the right. with the one caveat being, it doesn't matter how the team did. If you pick a team player, you obviously, if you take an individual player, that it does. But it doesn't matter. It's all statistically based, performance based,
right.
nothing to do with how their team did. So
now are we snake drafting or no? Are we going 1 and then 2, 3 and then 4, 5, or are we sticking with the old back and forth?
Well, I think that these drafts are so ridiculous, we should stick with the old form of just going
fair
one,
enough.
One. It is more fair, but I honestly believe that would not have helped me in the Star Wars draft too.
Oh no, you were doomed. You were doomed in that one. All right, who chose? I think I chose first last time, so I think you should choose
first. Did you choose first last time? All right. Well, basically, of the person I'm going to take number one, the person who sort of made me think up this draft in the first place, I'm going to take Wilt Chamberlain from 1961-62 season. That is the year that he scored 50.4 points per game, 25.7 rebounds per game. Shot the ball, on average, by the way, 40 field goals a game, 40 field goal attempts for Wilt. So, I mean, that's the guy's, he was a hog. And, but here's my favorite statistic. It may be my favorite statistic in all of these kinds of, you know, things. Averaged 48 and a half minutes a game.
Yeah.
A game being 48 minutes long. So he literally did not sit down the entire season.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry. I mean, look, I know it was a different game then. I understand that. You know, it wasn't the same up and down kind of. 48 and a half minutes a game average for the entire season.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's absurd. And of course, the 50, I mean, like 50.4 points a game is not absurd, but still, 48 and a half minutes, the guy was always, I mean, that would have been fun to watch him play just for that. I mean, always remember, like, the thing with the NBA, and I can remember this from my younger days, I loved Magic. I was a huge Magic Johnson fan. And so I would watch, and nothing depressed me more than seeing, like, Michael Cooper bring the ball up the court, because it meant Magic wasn't on there, on the floor. And it's like, this is like, I don't even want to watch. I'm just flipping the channel, you know, and then wait for Magic to come back. 48 and a half minutes. All right, so is that a legitimate number one overall pick?
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, obviously the game has changed a significant amount in the last 50 years, but whenever I see those stats, I always think, like, if Kevin Love has 23 rebounds or something, the whole world freaks out.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, my God, he had 20, or, if, you know, Dwight Howard has 24 rebounds in a game. It happens once a season or twice a season or something. He averaged 25 and a half rebounds a game. He averaged that. That means there were probably a lot of games where he had 37 rebounds.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just ridiculous. And again, it's a very, you know, the overall caveat for all of these things that we're going to choose is that these games change so radically. And
yes.
I actually eliminated some seasons based on the fact that the game had just changed too much. But no, that's a great, great choice. My number one choice is my favorite sports season I've ever witnessed personally, which is Pedro Martinez in 2000.
Sure.
So among my favorite statistics, he was 18-6. His ERA was 1.74. The league ERA that year in the American League was 4.91. So he was more than three runs better than the league ERA. His WHIP was 0.737. This is obviously at the height of the, you know, steroid era and everything else. So Roger Clemens was second in the league in ERA with 3.70. So Pedro was he was almost two runs better than the guy who was in second. His ERA in his losses was 2.44. So if you only took his ERA from the games he lost, he would have won the ERA title by more than a run. I mean, that's insane. He had 284 strikeouts and 32 walks, which is basically a 9-to-1 ratio. Which is, again, it's ridiculous. And, you know, as far as pitching seasons go, the kind of standard bearer for a long time was Bob Gibson's 1968, you know, and it was an unbelievable season. But the league ERA that year was under 3. And in 1968, there were 10 regulars in the National League that had an OPS of 800. I didn't do adjusted OPS because, obviously, the point of this is not to adjust it. So there were 10 people in the National League in 68 who had an OPS of 800. In the AL in 2000, there were 48 regulars who had an OPS of 800 or better. So I think that it's at the height of the steroid era, at the height of the offensive era, a guy who was, you know, 5'8 and weighed 160 pounds dominated the league so thoroughly and completely and effortlessly. It was, I think, the most fun I've ever had watching anybody play baseball with that year.
It's so amazing. You know, and what's so interesting is that his 99 season was about as good or
almost
or,
as good. Yeah, you could make an argument.
You could make an argument for it being better. He struck out more and all of that. But here's my favorite stat from that year, because, of course, it's on my list as well. The league hit 167 against him, which is obviously absurd. But they slugged 259 against him. That was slugging percentage against Pedro Martinez that year. And that is truly 2000 is the very height. I mean, that's 99, 2000, 2001. That is the very height of whether it's steroids or parks or the smaller strike zone or all of those things combined. It is the very height of the offensive insanity that hit baseball. And this guy just, I mean, he was pitching in 1968. I mean, he was pitching, you know, in like a pitcher's era, and he was so much fun to watch anyway because he didn't, you know, he had a great fastball, but he didn't throw it 102. I mean, it wasn't like he had Nolan Ryan's fastball, but he had the unbelievable changeup. He had all these pitches. He fielded. He did everything so well. You literally, there was no escape as a hitter, you know. And Greg Maddux has always been my favorite pitcher, you know, to watch pitch. And he was so dominant in the mid-90s. And it's not even close, I think, to Pedro in 2000. I mean, Pedro is like, it's like on a different plateau. I don't know how somebody gets that good at anything. I mean that. I mean, it's just, it's like whatever Shakespeare's best year was, you know, it's absolutely.
It's the Beatles 1966 or something. Yeah. It's just like everything he did was perfect.
It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. All right. Well, so I don't know if I want to go away. I mean, I on my list, I've got to go with baseball again as my second choice. Had a very, very, very difficult time picking between the two guys who I think you probably can imagine who they are for baseball. But I'm just going to go do it because we're just talking about dominance. I'm picking Barry Bonds in 2004. The numbers are insane, obviously, 362 average. He slugged 812, I just want to repeat that, by the way. Slug, not his OPS. His slugging percentage was 812. 45 homers, 263 OPS plus, just dominant. By the way, 45 homers, 41 strikeouts. You know, remember how everybody uses, like, the homer to strikeout thing for DiMaggio? You know, how amazing that. That was in addition to all the other insane things that Barry Bonds did during that stretch. He hit more homers than he struck out. But here's the thing that just put it over the top for me. And like I said, it was very, very close between him and the other guy. 120 intentional walks. 120 intentional walks. When you've gotten to the point in the game where you're too good for the game, you can't argue it. Now, again, obviously, everybody's going to say, if you put an asterisk on it, doesn't count, doesn't matter, doesn't whatever. We all know what he had to do to get there. Okay, I'm not arguing any of that right now. The guy got so good at baseball that when he would come up, managers said almost every single game he played, a manager said, no, just put him on first base. He's too good. He's like, you know, Kelly Leak from the Bad News Bears. He's too good. Forget it. He's too good for us. He should go to a different league. That's basically how good he was.
Yeah, the argument would be only between 2004 and 2001 for me, because 2001 was the 73 home run year. He had 177 walks. He had an 863 slugging percentage, which is silly. And that was the 400 total bases year. That was a 410 or 411 or something. So, yeah, I mean, it's close. You can really kind of pick any one of those years and say, like, that year is the best year. But it was weird to watch. It felt like you were a guy playing a different sport. And when he didn't hit a home run or walk, you were shocked. Yeah. Even if he hit a double, you were like, what happened? Why did he hit a double? That doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Of course, you put a giant asterisk next to it, and there will be an asterisk there for the rest of time. But, I mean, he had more intentional walks than most people ever have total walks in a season. So, yeah, it's hard to argue that.
609 on base percentage. That's really what put it over the top for me on the 01. I think in 01 he only had like a 560 on base percentage. Something, you know, some unbelievable thing that Ted Williams was like, how did you do that? But it doesn't – 609, I mean, that's absurd. The guy made it on base 61% of the time. I always hear people say, you know, like, oh, you know, when you know, as a hitter – it's the only sport where you can fail 70% of the... No, if you fail 70% of the time, you're terrible, okay? You're Jeff Francoeur. God bless Jeff, by the way.
Yeah.
But you are. But 61% of the time, the guy reached base that year. And look, all of the circumstances, including the fact... I mean, he only had that 2004 season because of 2001, 2002. I mean, he had built up to that extraordinary intentional walk numbers. But... that's one you could honestly say there will never be another season like that, ever.
Yeah. Oh, no, not even close.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
All right. Number two, I'm going to go with Tiger in 2000.
Good.
His best year, probably. So he won three majors. He was fifth at the Masters. Then he won the Open at Pebble Beach by 15 strokes. Mm-hmm. And the point of the U.S. Open, as I understand it, is that the course is supposed to be designed so that the winner wins at par. That's the idea behind the tournament.
Yes.
And he won by 15 strokes. He was 12 under. The runner-up was 3 over. So he won the Open at Pebble Beach by 15 strokes. Then he won the British by 8. And then he won the PGA in a playoff over Bob May. He won 9 tournaments overall. And that was the year that everybody said that the feeling was he will win every time he plays. It's like a little bit like Van Persie. It's like he scores when he wants to. At that moment, it was in Tiger in 2000, it was he wins when he enters. If he's in the tournament, he wins. And it was the year that he went from, you know, the young Masters phenom and in the kind of like the future of golf. He then just became golf. He wasn't the future of golf anymore. He was just golf. The only thing that mattered was him. You watched every shot of every tournament he ever played in, and you expected him to hit the best possible shot at any moment. And then, you know, he finished off the so-called Tiger Slam by winning the Masters the next year, I believe. And so he had won 4 in a row. He held all 4 major championships at the same time. But that year, I mean, it's crazy when the worst thing that happens to you in a year of golf is that you finish 5th at the Masters. And when you look back at it now, you're like, how did he not win? That doesn't make any sense. He should have won.
That year was...
It's one of those years that I don't think that'll ever happen again. I mean, and you've seen it, you know, since he's been gone, you now have a situation where a new person wins every Master or every major. There's a new winner every time now. And, you know, with the exception of Rory McIlroy recently, but that kind of dominance of winning 3 majors and winning 9 tournaments when he only entered, I don't know, 14 or something, you know, he wasn't playing that much even, was just phenomenal. So,
Well, you're absolutely right. And his dominance that year, it's like it changed what golf was. Cause I mean, I think even though there had been dominant players before, there was always this, I mean, you know, the famous thing about Jack Nicklaus is he won 18 majors, but he finished second 19 times. I mean, that was golf. You know what I mean? Golf was like you wanted to put yourself in position to win, but that didn't mean you would win. I mean, there was always going to be other people. But he just – that year, I mean, the 15 shots, you know, victory at the Open, and you know, that year he won the NEC by 11. I mean, he just dominated in such ways. But I actually was in Louisville when he beat Bob May in that playoff, and – the thing that was so amazing about that is he kind of was scuffling a little bit that last day. I mean, Bob May was staying with him. And he came to the 18th and he needed to make a pretty scary little putt to force the playoff. Both of them did. And he made it. It wasn't like he made it and it was like, oh, God, boy, good. Now I'm in a playoff or whatever. It was like he was angry. It was like, how dare this ball like not... just like, I should have won this by 8. I mean, it was like, there was such, and then he went on, and of course, that was the one where he did the famous point of the ball into the hole and on the first playoff when he made the birdie and everything. And I mean, it was one of the most extraordinary things I'd ever seen because it was done before it was done. Even though it was a playoff, even though anything could have happened, there was never a question that Tiger was going to win. And that's how good he was. I mean, I love watching it now. I think golf is in a great place now because Tiger is kind of, he's not back. He'll never be back like he was then, but he's good again. He's playing very, very well. Rory is a lot of fun. You got a couple of these other guys, Mickelson and some of the younger guys. It's kind of a fun time in golf, and McIlroy is tremendous, tremendous player. But whenever I hear anybody say, "Oh, you know, he could do with Tiger," that's a once in a, not even a lifetime. That's a once in a sport.
The
way Tiger was in 2000, he was amazing. All right, so I'm going to go with my third pick, which I'm going to go off the. It's obvious. It's an obvious choice. Everybody would know it'd be the third pick anyway. But I don't know that much because it's not my sport. But you got to go with Gretzky, 1981-82. Set the record for 92 goals, 120 assists, dominated in every single way. I mean, you can pick another year where Gretzky had more assists and all that, but the 92 goals, he had that year. Of course, that's still a record. He had 68 even strength goals. I mean, he was not a specialist in the way he did it. 68 even strength goals. Nobody's been within 10 of that since then. And he wasn't, you know, and he did it at an extraordinarily high rate. I mean, I was just looking at the numbers. He only shot, I'd say only, I mean, it was a lot, but he took 369 shots that year, which is 37th all time. So it's a lot, but it's not like historically a lot, but the 92 goals, obviously. And what I remember, I mean, I was a moderate hockey fan. There wasn't a lot of hockey you could watch really in Cleveland where I was living at the time. But when I would watch, all I would ever really remember is him standing behind the goal, you know, and then being able to just utterly dominate from that position. And obviously, I mean, you know, you're watching it as a kid and you're like, well, why doesn't somebody go back there and hit him or something, you know? And, and you don't know. And of course, my thinking now, as I look back on it, is one, I mean, there was some level of like, you know, he's Wayne Gretzky and you're not. But there was also, if you went back and tried to hit him, he would like score somehow, like you were just giving it to him if you did that. Obviously, it was, you know, I mean, when they call you the greatest, when that's your nickname, you know, Great Gretzky, you've done all right for yourself.
Yeah, you're the greatest. That was my season I had chosen for Gretzky too. I had him. He was going to be my fourth pick. So you it might be a reach for you at three. Is all I'm saying. You know, you could argue the 85-86 season, he had the 163 assists, which is an absurd number. That's an absurd number. That's two assists a game, basically. But in that year, that 92 goals is such a gaudy number. It's just so amazing. My favorite stat about Gretzky, and I don't know if this is true or not. I'm not the biggest hockey fan in the world, but I believe it was true, at least at one point when he retired, that if he had never scored a goal, he still would have been the all-time NHL points leader. He had more assists than anyone else had combined assists and goals, which is so ridiculous. And obviously it's a tribute to the guys who played on his teams, the Yari Currys and the Messiers and everybody else. But yeah, it's a phenomenal statistic that he was essentially a pass first guy in many ways. And yet, you know, he still had 92 goals that year.
Yeah. I remember actually talking to people about it, like, you know, not being a huge hockey fan, but liking the sport. And I would talk to people who were big hockey fans and they'd say, oh, who's the best on the breakaway? And I'd say, well, it's gotta be Gretzky, right? They're like, no, not even close. That wasn't Gretzky's game. I mean, he wasn't that good on the breakaway. He was just much more tactical. I'm sure he was good, but he wasn't like with the Mike Bossies or the Mike Gartners or some of these other guys. But the one thing I will say about the 85-86 season, the reason I didn't choose that, 163 assists, amazing. But I did start hearing, even then, if he was, like, anywhere in the building, they would give him an assist at that point. You know what I mean?
It
was
kind of like, interesting.
Yeah. Because, I mean, what is it like? It's like the last two passes both get an assist, and then it's like there's a Gretzky rule where if he was, like, happened to be looking the way of the goal at the time, he got an assist. So I'm not saying the numbers are padded. I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's at some point, like a great hitter will get, you know, ball four when somebody else will get strike three. I mean, I'm not questioning that. But to me, the goals, you can't – there's nothing to take away from a goal. A goal is a goal. Like, there's no judgment call on that like there is.
So what you're saying is you think Gretzky was overrated. Okay, good.
I think that's fair.
All right, my third pick, I'm going with Barry Sanders, 1988, Oklahoma State.
Okay.
2,850 rushing yards. He averaged more than 7 yards a carry. He scored 44 touchdowns. He had 3,250 total yards. Now, this includes the Holiday Bowl. I think it was the Holiday Bowl game numbers. In that, but who cares, really? In the bowl game, he had 222 yards rushing and 5 touchdowns and sat out the fourth quarter because they were up like 62-10 or something. So, you know, it's a little tricky with college football. The teams, the competition is obviously very different, and the you never know. Oklahoma State had a weak schedule and et cetera, et cetera. But that those numbers are just ridiculous. 44 touchdowns in 10 games or 11 games. And, you know, for a guy who then arguably became, you know, he's a top 5, top 10 all-time running back in the NFL, so you know it wasn't just a crazy fluke. And that year, I remember there was something about him, it's a little like Pedro, actually, that it wasn't Eric Dickerson or Earl Campbell. It was this little tiny dude who was quiet, and when he scored a touchdown, he just flipped the ball back to the ref, and he was like, you know, he looked like I could beat him up. And I remember watching some of those games. I remember watching that bowl game and just, you know, just this is the best guy. This was the best running back in the league. He was going to be a Hall of Famer. There was no question about it.
Yeah. He is to me the single most exciting running back who's ever played football, any level, any sport. I mean, it was his ability to appear and disappear and make two guys miss and cut between them, and it was incredible. I actually am really good friends with a guy who was on the Kansas State football team that year. He was a freshman, and he always talks about that game because he would be like on the sideline, and Oklahoma State would go on the field, and they'd hand the ball off to Barry Sanders, and he'd score. Like literally, like, oh, 70, you know, he'd be like, well, what? Oh, and Barry Sanders scores again, you know, and he would score 78 yards, and then they'd go on the field, three out and punt. And then they'd give it to him, and then they hand it off to him, and he'd score. I mean, it was just like literally just over and over and over again. And, you know, I mean, there have been so many. Marshall Faulk, his year, Larry Johnson, Marcus Allen. I mean, there have been a lot of incredible statistical seasons by a lot of different guys. But I think what made that so fundamentally different was exactly what you're saying. It was and you know, Reggie Bush had a little bit of this as well. It was not just he was doing it. I'm losing the guy's name. The guy at Wisconsin who ran for 2,000 yards and won the Heisman. The big guy. Yeah. Again, sad that I lose his name. But
sad that I am too.
But, you know, when he did it, it was like, all right, that's great. Here's a 27-yard run, and he'd run over two guys, whatever. Barry Sanders, it was like, you just didn't have it. He might bury himself under the ground, and you'd be looking around for him, and he'd pop up on the other side. He might fly over you. I mean, it was always superhuman what he did. And then he went to the NFL, and it was still superhuman. I mean, it's like it didn't matter how good the level of defender became, they still couldn't tackle him. It was absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, Ron Dane is the guy we're looking for, right?
Ron Dane, very good. I thought we were going to have to come back to that. All right. Well, since you went with football, I'm going to go a different direction. My fourth pick. Had a real issue with this one, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to go ahead and choose Martina Navratilova, 1983.
Interesting.
I'm going to go a little tennis with you here. Thought about a lot of different people in tennis, and there are a lot of women tennis players. Very difficult to go away from Steffi Graf's golden, you know, slam year, the one she won the Grand Slam and the Olympics and all that.
Yeah.
You know, Monica Seles had incredible years and. But I'm going to go with Martina for two reasons. She went 86-1 that year. She lost one time, and it was that really bizarre loss to Helena Suková at the Australian Open. She won the first one 6-1, and then I don't know. I don't have a great memory of it, but I think she fell asleep. I mean, I literally think she fell asleep. And she still only lost like 7-5 in the third. And then she didn't lose the rest of the year. So that was it. So she was done. But what separates it for me with her is, so she won the other three slams and didn't lose another match and won every single other tournament she entered. She also won the Grand Slam in doubles. That, to me, is what, like, takes it up to a whole different level. So, 86-1 in singles, one loss in the Australian Open right at the beginning of the year, doesn't lose again, wins the Grand Slam in doubles. I'm going to go with it. I'm going to even over Steffi's incredible year, even over Federer and you know, and then going, you know, way back to the Lavers and all that. I don't think anybody's ever been that much better than the competition than Martina was that year.
That's fair. Now, I'm going to do something a little out of the ordinary, which is I'm going to skip to my fifth pick.
Ooh.
And come back to my fourth pick.
Wow.
Because my Steffi Graf's 88 was my fifth pick. So I chose her over Martina, first of all, because she won the Grand Slam.
Yeah.
And she won the Olympics gold. It's the, you know, and obviously that's a little bit of a fluke. You have to win the Grand Slam in a year divisible by four.
Sure.
So it's not like a thing that you can do every year, but still it's a neat trick
it's
to win
incredible.
The Grand Slam and the Olympics gold medal in the same year. She was 19 years old. She won the French Open 6-love, 6-love in like 30 minutes. She was 72-3 overall. Now she might have been better the following year. She was 86-2 and she won 14 out of 16 tournaments she played in. And you could argue that she was better, but just the neatness and tidiness of winning the Grand Slam and the Olympics gold medal, winning a major tournament at Love in 30 minutes, which obviously it's for the people who were there at the final is probably pretty boring and sad. But that is, to me, that's such dominance. I mean, she served six times and broke her opponent six times and won in 30 minutes. And that was my pick and I was, by the way, deeply in love with her when I was a kid. I was a huge tennis fan, and I was that year I fell very deeply in love with Steffi Graf, and it still pained me a little bit that she chose Andre Agassi over me.
I believe Steffi Graf has even made it onto Parks and Recreation, has she not?
She's been mentioned, yes. Ron Swanson has mentioned that he is a fan of strong, independent women, and she was one of the. It's no accident that she was one of the women that he cited. Yeah.
Yes, and deservedly so. It was absolutely. I loved Steffi too. It was heartbreaking for me to choose one, because I think both those years are absolutely amazing, and the fact that Steffi won the Grand Slam and Martina didn't would put Steffi perhaps up a notch. But again, the doubles thing just completely, just, I think they both were really good years. So that we'll go with that. All right. So that's,
yeah.
So now, are you?
No, you go to your fifth pick, and I'll go backwards to my fourth.
Okay. Well, my fifth pick. There's one year that I think you're gonna pick, and I wasn't gonna pick it. And so I'm not. I'm gonna leave it to you and hope that you choose it so we can argue about it, because I have a strong feeling. So my fifth pick, I'm gonna pass on Earl Anthony in 1975 in bowling, although that was a very, very good year for him. First bowler to win $100,000.
Interesting.
I knew I didn't have to tell you that. Here's what I was thinking about Earl Anthony in 1975. First, he won seven times. He broke all the records. He won the U.S. Open for the third year in a row. He dominated. Earl Anthony, greatest bowler ever. And a guy I was lucky enough to interview, very nice man. But the thing I loved about that is he made $100,000, $107,000. So he broke the $100,000 barrier. Joe Morgan did not make $100,000 in 1975. The year he might have made right at $100,000. Earl
Wow.
Anthony in bowling won more money than the MVP of the National League, Joe Morgan, in one of the great years in baseball history.
That's a great stat.
I just thought that was interesting. All right, but I am going to go with my fifth pick, and I'm going to go with Jim Brown in 1958. It's not necessarily Jim Brown's best year, by the way, 1958, but it was his first full year. And what I love about it is one of the things that I was thinking about when you think about the greatest seasons ever are those seasons that seem so utterly out of character for the time. Like later, maybe those seasons, like the first guy to throw for 4,000 yards or the first guy to do something. How dominant were they in that particular year? Jim Brown ran for 1,527 yards that year, which was a record. And
right.
Next in line was Alan Ameche at 791. They only played 12 games, so 1,500 yards. You know, if you play 16, 100, he had 127 yards a game, so it would have been, you know, at 16 games, it would have been, you know, close to 2,000 yards. So it was it was an incredible year for him. He scored 17 touchdowns. The next guy scored 9. But I think the thing that makes it to me the greatest year for him, and even though, like I said, he had better years, and O.J. Simpson, of course, had better year and all that, statistically, is just these guys had no idea how to deal with it. It was like something, it was just something, you know, that's when they started really calling him Superman, and just, you know, you hear these great stories from these old defensive players about, you know, that they would tackle Jim Brown by basically, like, you know, running from him and hoping he might trip on their feet. You know, I mean, it was just the stories of how they dealt with this guy that kind of came from outer space for them. Amazing. And that's why Jim Brown, I mean, when you hear, you talk to old timers, they'll tell you, and I'm sure in the same way that we will someday say or are saying now about, you know, Michael Jordan or something, you couldn't be better than Jim Brown was because he was something so new, this big, powerful guy who could, you know, run, you know, incredibly fast. It was just a combination unlike anything anybody had ever seen. So, Jim Brown, 1958.
Yeah, it's a good call. And I, you know, again, football was a very different game. But sure. But he's one of the only guys that you think that if you took him out of 1958 and put him in the league today, that he'd do just fine.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he was 6'2", and he weighed 240 pounds or whatever, and he could run really fast. And he seems like a guy who, you know, he scored 18 touchdowns that year or something. It's like he in 12 games, and it was a very dominant performance. I'm going to go back up to my number four pick and do the thing that you assumed I think I would do, which is pick Tom Brady.
Sure.
07-08. Is that what you thought I was going to do?
It is exactly what I thought you were going to do. And it's good because I've got it prepared. I've got my little argument prepared.
So there's an obvious argument. I'm going to make your argument against him for you, which is that he lost the Super Bowl. And that is a fair argument. However, in this course of the season, he threw for 4,800 yards. He threw 50 touchdowns, which is a record. He threw 8 interceptions with those 50 touchdowns. His team went 16-0. It never happened before. He turned Randy Moss from a guy whose career was completely over in Oakland to a guy who set the all-time NFL record for touchdown receptions in a season. It was as dominant a quarterback performance as you'll ever see. You know, you could actually weirdly argue that last year Brady had a better year because he threw for 5,200 yards and, you know, not as many touchdowns, but, you know, it was like 4 interceptions all year. But that season, that 16-0 season was incredible. And, you know, as far as not winning the Super Bowl goes, the thing I come back to is, like, his job is to score points. And he didn't lose the game for his team. He had his team winning with him with a couple minutes left to play. The last time he had the ball, his team was winning. So, you know, it's an easy argument and a legitimate argument, obviously. He didn't win his last game, and that means that the season, part of the reason it's such an incredible season is because of the undefeated thing. They were 18-0 going to the Super Bowl, and then they lost, and that's a totally legit argument. But as far as quarterback play goes, I don't think it gets better than 50 touchdowns and 8 picks. And by the way, you know, at the time, Marino's yardage record was still in play, 5,084 yards, and Brady sat out many quarters because the team was up 42-3 or something, and then they just put him on the bench. He sat out a lot of game time, and there's very, very little doubt that if he had any interest or if they'd wanted to break that record, that he could have very easily broken the record. So, you know, it's as good a year as a quarterback can have in today's NFL.
Totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. And my argument against Tom Brady is not really against Tom Brady. It's not the Super Bowl thing. My argument is that Aaron Rodgers last year was just as good as
interesting.
This is my argument because I was like going, all right, look, I got to put Tom Brady's number in here. He had an incredible year. And, of course, I look online, and I'm like, all right, well, let me just rank him by passer rating so I can get to Brady. And I saw Rodgers' passer rating is higher from last year. 45 touchdowns, 6 interceptions, 4,643 yards. Of course, sat out the last game in that classic where the other guy came in and threw 6 touchdown passes or whatever. And I just thought, well, can it be that dominant a season if – basically, Aaron Rodgers had just about the same year last year. You know.
Yes, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. Because Tom Brady is incredibly handsome. And that pushes him over the – and Aaron Rodgers is a fine-looking gentleman. But Tom Brady is so handsome and good-looking that to me is what – that's part of his dominance, is how handsome he is.
I was arguing for Aaron Rodgers in his fine performances in those State Farm commercials. I thought those added
– those are fine
dominance.
Performances. But when I drive home in Los Angeles on Highland Avenue, there is a giant – UGG boot billboard of Tom Brady that is so distracting to me because of how handsome he is that I've nearly wrecked my car like 5 or 6 times.
You're saying so that if it was Aaron Rodgers on the UGG boots, that drive home would be all right.
No problem. My commute's easy. But when there's a 40-story Tom Brady staring at me, my heart flutters and I get very nervous and I lose concentration and I almost wreck my car.
You know what's sad is that Dan Fouts loses so much in this argument because
– Oh, yeah. Forget it. Yeah. Sorry, man. Great, great career. Hall of Fame career. But, you know, sorry, buddy.
Sorry. It just doesn't work for you. It's just not – I don't even think he has UGG boots. Brady's 2007 is incredible, by the way. I actually very strongly considered, even though it's not statistically as good as Brady or Rodgers or Peyton Manning, Marino's year. Only because in the same way that Jim Brown's year just – do you remember?
What the hell is this?
What is this? Yeah, but you're watching it. It's like the guy throws 3 touchdowns every single week. You're not allowed to do that.
The other things ones I consider, just for the record, were Messi last year for Barcelona.
Yes.
He lost points to me because there's a legitimate argument that Cristiano Ronaldo is actually as good or almost as good.
Plus, he would not distract you on a poster.
Ronaldo would.
Ronaldo would, yes. Although he wouldn't be on the poster, he would take a fall at some point.
I also considered Oscar Robertson in 61-62. I don't know if that was on your list. He averaged a triple-double that year.
I threw, obviously, Michael Phelps. You gotta throw the gold medals, and Eric Heiden and Jesse Owens were on mine. One of the guys that was on mine was Sir Don Bradman in cricket.
I looked at that too.
It's really sad.
We went to the
minds.
Same websites to prepare.
Yeah, we did. Batting average of 99.94, which apparently just about twice as good as anybody else ever. So
yeah.
I don't even know what it means, but it sounds. I think it means, honestly, that for every out he made, he scored 99.94 runs.
Yeah,
I mean, I literally think that's what that means.
That's correct.
If anybody did that in baseball, that'd be impressive. I mean, 20 outs and scored 200 runs. You know, I mean, that would be pretty impressive. But yeah,
well, I think it's pretty clear that I won this draft easily. we'll let the listeners decide. But,
the listeners will decide, and obviously they can decide. I think that the hash mark. For their prizes, of course, if you want to.
By the way, every time we do this, we say if you listen all the way to the end and you use this hashtag in a tweet or something, then you'll be eligible to win a prize. And then like a year goes by, and we have no way of finding the people who listened and giving them a prize. I mean, we're probably violating some kind of FCC rule here because we keep saying that there's a prize, and we haven't given away a prize in the last 3 or 4 of these things.
Yeah, and we're not this time either. But, you know, the thing is that we need to keep it going. No, I think that we should give away prizes. Because now it's a new thing. We're Sports on Earth, and here at Sports on Earth, we give prizes. In fact, I think that's our slogan.
Now, how is this going to work? Is there like a comment section under this thing? Can we do that instead of Twitter? That might be easier.
Oh, we could do a comments. Yeah, we could, but it'd be people could pretend that they heard through. If
I'm going to say we should do it on the comments. It'll be easier to track and just say like, come on, dudes, honor system here.
Honor system.
Like, don't claim you listened all the way to the end of this ridiculous, interminable podcast unless you actually did, because that would be uncool.
I'm going to just say point blank. You want a prize? Hashtag Joe won. I think really is probably the best way to do that. I think that could keep it going. I think you know what? Hashtag Sir Don Bradman. But we'll do it in the comments. You don't have to do it in Twitter.
Right.
Go to the comments. I'm going to write a little story about our draft and how I won it, because that's what I get to do. If you want to put it on your little TV show that you won, that's fine. But I've got a story that I can put it in. We'll put this
draft. How about this? If you think Joe wins the draft, you do hashtag Sir Don Bradman. If you think I won the draft, you do hashtag Tom Brady is handsome. And then we'll each give away a prize for that.
Oh, I love this. All right. Yes, Sir Don Bradman, if you think I won, and Tom Brady is handsome, if you think sadly you think Michael won.
Or by the way, if you just agree with me that Tom Brady's handsome, you can also just do that. I would just like that to be written a lot on the internet.
I'm going to write it several times in the story. I can tell you. And then I think please come to sportsonearth.com. We're going to be building this thing around hopefully really cool, fun sports writing, and this is the only place that you're going to be able to get a recap of how I won this draft. I mean, that's really the main point of this whole thing.